When did it happen? So the answer is Vayhid Mei Achashverosh. Fixing the time of the events. All those events which Megillah is about to narrate happened in the time of Achashverosh. Second, Igeres is more than a tale at a higher level. More than a descriptive chronicle recording dry facts, naked, isolated events in chronological order. It's more than that. Igeres, at the second level, contains not just a story, but a living history. At the first level, that of description and observation, Igeres is just a story. It's not history as yet. At the second level, Igeres becomes history, and history is living. Igeres, at the higher level, is not only informing, as it is at the first level, but interpreting as well. It addresses itself at the second level, not only to the platitudinous, fact-prying, gossip-enjoying, excuse the colloquialism, nosy instinct, but to our knowledge-questing, inquisitive mind as well. Of course, Igeres, even at this level, does narrate, certainly. Yet its main task is to explain, not only to tell a story. Igeres at that level not only describes, but also interprets. It links up events, sets them up against their proper causal background, and points out their fundamental patterns of development. In short, at this stage, Igeres is not a descriptive chronicle or story, but interpretive history. Our rabbi said, Gemara Megillah, Nikras Igeres, Shimhitil Boshle Shachutim Kshero. The scrolls must be held together by stitches. Three at least. Of course, the stitches symbolize the unity of the tale, the causative unfolding of the event, interpretation. At this level, the idea of emet, truth, with which the Igeres at its higher level, as I said before, must comply, is related to interpretation rather than to observation, as we have explained before. It is a truth achieved not just through careful, cautious observation, but through correct thinking, profound analysis, and thorough understanding of events. By simply listening to the heartbeat of history, it is the kind of truth which is binding not on the witness, as the case was before, but on the dayan, on the judge, who in contrast to the aid, to the witness, is interested in the causal nexus of events, in motivation, interrelatedness, and interaction. The truth in this context is not descriptive, not matter of fact, but inventive, and I would say creative. What is safer vis-à-vis a garris? Safer in contradistinction to a garris at both levels signifies certainly a book. But when the Gemara says safer, the Gemara had something else in mind. It's not just a book, but a book written under the impact of divine inspiration, under the impact and influence of Ruach HaKodesh. It's a prophetic book. Sefer, as an inspired book, is not interested in a story. Nor is it concerned even with history. If history be understood as the science of individual events, as the science of one-timely occurrences that took place once and vanished into oblivion. Sefer, if it's a part of the Kisvei HaKodesh, of the canon, is concerned not with individual events, but with universality, whose truth is not limited to a single epoch or particular set of circumstances that will hardly repeat itself. As I said before, for the safer, history ceases to be a science of the individual, particular, single event and becomes the metaphysique of the universal, general, symbolic, the constant and the perpetual law. Events for the Sefer, for the Chronicle, they are events. For the Sefer, they turn into symbols. For the Chronicle, historical figures, the actors in the historical drama, are people that live and die. For the Sefer, historical figures that lived once upon a time become archetypes or prototypes whose image is stamped time and again upon all those who emerge in the historical arena. Thus, the Sefer does not tell us the story of yesteryear of an individual who lived and died long, long ago, or of a community of a certain day and age, but Sefer tells us the perennial old new story of human destiny in general and Jewish destiny in particular. Sefer moves events from the particular, from the transient and the one-timely toward the universal, steady, omnipresent and dynamic in the great drama of human destiny. At this point, the idea of truth transcends that of factual observation as well as that of causalistic interpretation and reaches at the level of the Sefer into the realm of inspiration. Truth at this stage is of a predictive nature. To be truthful means to be inspired, to enjoy clairvoyance, to see in every individual fact the fingerprints of universality, in each psychic phenomenon, to see in each passing phenomenon what a certain historian Rankes called once, the trends of the centuries and the traces of the millennia. The Sefer sees in every individual fact the reflection of the internal, of the inevitable, and in each plot, the manifestation of the elan vital of human and Jewish destiny. The truth of the Sefer is revealed, not discovered, beheld as a vision, not just inferred by logical judgment. Numa gever shemeya imrekel, ashamachaze shada yecheze, nefel gluenoim. Word of the man whose eye is true. In short, Megillas Esther as a Sefer is a part of the Sefer HaSforim, of the canon of the Tisri HaKedesh. It is, I would say, an halachic book. Maimonides expressed himself, Arihi Kayemes, the scroll of Esther, will be as permanent, Kechamisho Chum Sheteiro, like the five books of Moses, and like the statues of Torah Shabbat. It's an halachic book, replete with rules, principles and criteria which should guide us as human beings and as Jews. And tonight, when I gave my topic or the theme of my address, I did not foresee the difficulties which I'll encounter in writing this paper. But once I said I had to implement my promise. Tonight I wish to analyze just a few ideas which are relevant to our present involvement in the contemporary historical struggle. The Jews are now involved in a strange manner in the struggle between the two titans, the East and the West, two systems of government, two societies, two communities, two philosophies. I would like to try tonight to interpret our unique position, and in particular, and the struggle and the clash between the two titans in general in terms of Megillas Esther, to study contemporary events in biblical and halachic categories. Mm-hmm. And I warn you, there is a subtle analysis. I wish you would pay attention later to it. You think, how do I know it's subtle? Perhaps it's bad. So you'll be the judges later. Let us just get a glimpse first, before we get involved in metaphysics, into the story of Esther. The story of Esther tells us in the most lively fashion, with a tinge of refined yet biting sarcasm, about paradoxical events. And forgive me again the use of the colloquialism, I would say crazy events. It's the best description, which are both tragic and comical at the same time. We are told a story about or of a king who, as our rabbis Chazal have already remarked sarcastically, kill this beautiful, beloved young queen. It's quite possible she was his bride. At the suggestion, of a friend, Memuchan. It's quite possible that Memuchan was Haman, same person. And later, short time later, hanged his best friend, or the same friend, who in the meantime succeeded to rise to the top of the Persian hierarchy upon the complaint of his beautiful queen and bride Esther. It is a strange story, which is bold, as I said before, sad and funny, about a king per se neither wicked nor cruel. Chazal say he was not too intelligent. But a story about a king who signed upon the spur of the moment a decree, an edict, to exterminate a people whose identity he did not know, and about a people, to destroy a people, but whom he simply did not make in any inquiry. And a short time later, forgot the whole incident, became very indignant. Then Esther told him what the content of the edict was. It is a story about a commonwealth where many races lived, many languages were spoken, many rituals and cults practiced. It is a story about a pluralistic society, there is no doubt about it. Culturally, religiously, which suddenly decided to commit genocide for one reason only. The people who were to be exterminated were abiding by the religious statutes and laws that differed from those of other people. Something else is puzzling. It is almost frightening. It is a story about millions and millions of people, among whom there were certainly countless liberal-minded, decent individuals who accepted the satanic, bloodthirsty, murderous royal edict indifferently in cold blood. It's a story about a conspiracy of silence agreed to by the entire population of the great Persian Empire. No one interfered. And mind you, it's very simple. It was permissible to demonstrate in Shushan. Not were afraid. The proof that it was permissible is quite obvious. Mordechai did parade in the streets of the capital wrapped in sackcloth with ashes on his head, and he cried with a bitter and loud cry. Mordechai even demonstrated in front of the royal palace. No guards blocked his way, yet no one else joined him. Neither friend, he certainly had many friends, nor stranger. Where Shushan Navecha, the city of Shushan, was perplexed. The Jews did not believe. They refused to face reality. The non-Jew did not care. Period. Moreover, The story is puzzling from another viewpoint, because of a very strange coincidence. A short time before, the entire population was invited to the 7-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. The invitations were extended to everybody, without a single exception, Jew and Gentile alike, to all races, faith, because the Megillah states in unmistakable terms, "Lecholom amimtziim b'Shushan Abiro," and to all the people who were present in Shushan. They, of course, as guests of the king, fraternized, drank toast, shook hands, and hugged each other. And a little later, the ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily with the couriers to all parts of the commonwealth, lehashmi, leharig, ulehavig, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. And the question, rises spontaneously, how was it possible, we ask ourselves, that the same friends just a week ago or 2 weeks ago before, shook hands with them, paid compliments to each other, and drank together, and ate together, and feasted together, should not raise their voice in protest? There is a very cryptic remark in the Megillah. Orotzim yotzutrufim bidvar ha-melech ve'ados nitno b'shushan abiro ha-melech ve'homon yoshvu lishteis v'yoshushan ha-recho. The post went forth in haste and the decree was given out in Shushan and the king in Haman sat down to drink and the city of Shushan was bewildered. Not in grief, as some translations render it. Navecha means bewildered. The king and Haman celebrated. What? I don't know. You can tell me, I would be grateful to you. By feasting on the wine, I read somewhere, I don't remember where it was, that the dignitaries of the Nazi party, after they had completed their work, and the famous Weissensee document dealing with the final solution of the Judenfrage feasted until dawn on Frankfurt and beer. Achashverosh like to wine, they like beer. They are Germans. I believe that many questions rise, and I don't have to enumerate them. And I also believe the same questions are applicable to a more recent event, to a more recent epoch. It's almost a replica of what the Megillah tells us, with one difference only. As far as the story of 2500 years ago is concerned, it was just a conspiracy which has never been implemented. In the 40s, it was not just a conspiracy. It was a reality. I don't like to complain. I don't like to ask for justice. I don't like to simply to tell the world, how cynically it acted. I would like tonight, as Spinoza said, not to cry and not neither to cry nor to laugh, neither to criticize, nor to approve or to condone, but simply just understand. And here we are coming to a metaphysical analysis of man. I would like you to listen carefully. The answer to that riddle can be found in our philosophy of man as a dual dichotomous being, burdened with an inner contradiction, an intrinsic conflict. It's within him, I said it on another occasion, but it wouldn't do harm, I mean, to repeat it. Yahadus, Judaism, has never accepted the so-called two-valued logic developed by Aristotle, whose foundation is the principle of contradiction and also the principle of the excluded middle. And Aristotle, in all simplicity, and our Greek can afford to be simple, we can't afford. We are complex natures. As that, if there is A and B, and A contradicts B, so either A is wrong or B is wrong. Both cannot be right. I said that quite often in the halachic realm, I'm simply speaking now about halachic concepts, we ignore the Aristotelian principle as modern physics does today as well. In the field of nuclear physics, both principles by Aristotle being not abandoned but completely suspended, if necessary. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle. The halacha has known that secret for a long time. And the halacha many times accepts both A and B, even though A and B are mutually exclusive. The halacha believes that dovor v'ifuchei, both can be true. That there is a possibility for a contradictio in the adjecto or objecto to be true without negating the truth of the opposite statement. I could prove it to you on purely halachic grounds if I had more time tonight. Don't get scared, I'm not lying. However, in the halacha it is true, but not fundamental, not basic. We could get along in the halacha even with the Aristotelian principle, even accepting the principle of contradiction and that of the excluded middle. In Jewish philosophy, it would be impossible simply to understand or to comprehend the very essence of our world outlook, of our Weltanschauung, without abandoning or eliminating the Aristotelian principle or the Aristotelian two-valued logic. Let us now, pay our attention to man. Halacha had a dialectical approach to man. There is a thesis, and there is an antithesis. On the one hand, Yahadus looked upon man with a sympathetic, appreciative eye. Indeed, I would say with admiration. Could you tell me whether the term admiration is in the proper context? Did Yahadus admire man or didn't he? What do you say about it? I said admiration. Should have stopped me, perhaps. Is there a manifestation of admiration and great, profound respect for man? Of course there is. I believe it is in Psalm Chesed, not 8. It's 8, or perhaps I make a mistake. Ches. Kilshvat at chasreyu meat melekim. V'koved v'odo pe'atreo is just, he's one bit lower than the angels, and he's surrounded with dignity and majesty. Yehadus has time and again expressed faith in him. Not only Yehadus has admired man, has also expressed faith in man. And believed in the human uniqueness, in his royal status in nature, in his contemplative, meditative powers. After all, Yehadus said, he is the only rational being in the universe. Perhaps you'll find some, on a distant star, who were there. That this thesis that Yehadus had a sympathetic, optimistic approach to man is correct can be attested by something else, proven by something else. And I believe this proof is incontrovertible. The fact that Yehadus has granted man moral freedom, but complete, unrestricted, unqualified moral freedom. The human being enjoys unrestricted moral freedom. God does not want to interfere with man's liberty to plot his own existential course. Apparently, man is deserving of freedom. Were man undeserving of freedom, he wouldn't have received that grant, the most precious of gifts, which God had bestowed upon people, upon the human being, upon the world, upon creation. It has not been granted to any other future. And moral freedom, according to the Rambam, to Maimonides, is a tenet of our faith. In spite of the fact that he has not included moral freedom among the Shleish Esrei, the 13 articles of faith. On the other hand, Yehadus has treated man with extreme caution, I would say even suspicion. The reason for the Judaic skepticism concerning man is due to our historical experience and our long memory that have been hunting the Jews since time immemorial. Namely, the experience and the memory that man who is endowed with divine rationality may turn at a moment's notice into either a non-rational or even an irrational being. And therefore, Yehadus took all extravaganza of man in stride. Was never too much impressed when man did go berserk. So was never stunned, amazed, or taken aback watching the latter man suddenly run amok. There is, in the opinion of Yehadus, no element of surprise in man's abrupt changes and unpredictable transformations. His unpredictability is a part of his humanity, And I would say his unpredictability is predictable. I've just said that man either turns, man is a rational being, but he quite often, frequently, man turns into either a non-rational or an irrational being. So let me now analyze it. And here the analysis begins. It means that man has three alternatives, three options. Either can be a rational being, or it can be a non-rational being, hyphenated, of course. And if he wants, he can even become an irrational being. What do these three alternatives represent? Rationality, non-rationality, and irrationality. In order to understand exactly what is meant under non-rationality in contradistinction to irrationality, we must inquire into the source of the threefold schism in the human personality. We may ask what causes the threefold split, the triple conflict and feud within him. What lies at the root? Man is a limited being. He is burdened with finiteness. He is a finite being. And he is aware of it. He is simply burdened with finiteness awareness, for he himself experiences his finiteness. It's not something which has got to be told to him that you are a finite being, a restricted being, a limited being. He knows it, if he wants to know the truth, that he is finite. It's an awareness. He experiences, existentially, metaphysically, his incompleteness and imperfection, his closeness to nothingness. He knows that his power is restricted, knowledge nil, vigor ebbing with age, his years are numbered, successes few, frustrations many, and in general, his existential prospects are bleak at best. Per se, it is a metaphysical awareness. It's not a psychological awareness. It is a metaphysical, it's an existential awareness. It's a part of the greater awareness of that if I exist. Excellent. I exist as a limited being. I exist as a finite creature. I exist as an imperfect and incomplete being. However, this metaphysical awareness, this existential awareness, it's not psychological. Like our consciousness of we exist is not a psychological one. It's much deeper. It lies at the very root of the human psyche. The human psyche may express that awareness of I exist. But if what the I exist is the very root of our mentality and our psychological constitution. However, this knowledge, even though metaphysical, finds its expression also in psychological experiences, in disordered moods, in man-me being dissatisfied with himself, disenchanted with the world, and who is not disenchanted with others, with themselves, fools are not dissatisfied. In being angry with everybody, including himself, it expresses itself in the restlessness of the young. I mean not the American of 1969-70 brand. I mean old-fashioned restlessness of the young. It's not something which you have discovered. I was also restless as a young boy, but I expressed it in a different fashion. I might say in a more dignified fashion. But there was dissatisfaction, there was rebellion, there was insurrection in me. In the restlessness, I don't know whether they do it now, but girls used to do it. We lock themselves suddenly up in a room, bury their heads in pillows and cry for no reason to justify that mood. This knowledge of finiteness, of imperfection and incompleteness finds, as I said, its expression manifestation in young boys disapproving of their parents, young boys hating Pa and being contemptuous of Ma, and parading and striking and demonstrating. It finds its expression in the loneliness and desolation of the elderly, and then also in the fear of the middle age, who are about to become old, to get old. There are no reasons. If you investigate, you investigate all those moods, and they are passing moods, but nevertheless real, you wouldn't find any, you would not discover the theology, so to say, or the causal background of such moods. Because they reach much deeper, they go back to the awareness, the I exist awareness, which is both affirming and negating man. I exist, yes, affirming, but at the same time, I exist as an imperfect being, as an incomplete being. All those moods, all those experiences, we call psychological experiences, reflect the fundamental awareness of man, of being incomplete, finite, and therefore considers his existence unwarranted and unjustified. I know what many of you think now. I'm a pretty good mind reader. I mean, as far as my pupils are concerned, Rabbi Soloveitchik has become an existentialist. True or false, I don't know, perhaps I am. But I'll tell you, if I am an existentialist, I'm not a Sartre, or Heidegger, or Jaspers brand. I am a much older brand. You know of whose? Of Sefer Tehillim, of the books of Sarah. If there was an existentialist, and the greatest of all, was it the psalmist. And he spoke about the finiteness awareness, the awareness of incompletion, of incompleteness, rather, and imperfection. What name did he coin for that awareness? Not such a fancy name as finiteness. I don't know whether the term is grammatically correct. But however, what name did he coin for that? No? Right? The Sami speaks about Mimamakim Krosicho Adishem. The depth, the profundis, at which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Minameitzar Krosicho, from the straight, because straights are narrow, but from existential narrowness, Krosicho. What are those Mimamakim? What are they? The depth, the profundis, at which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Minameitzar Krosicho, from the straight, because straights are narrow, but from existential narrowness, Krosicho. What are those Mimamakim? What are they? Not peace. What is that Minameitzar? What kind of straits are they? Of course, what are those Mimamakim? What is that Minameitzar, if not the experience of finiteness or metaphysical distress which abides in man? Interestingly, as the Zohar speaks of 10 Mimamakim, 10 aspects of the human awareness of incompleteness. Of course, I'll speak later about our halachic approach to the problem of the finiteness awareness, the problem of Mimamakim. By the way, you wouldn't find it in Erev. But there is an halachic interpretation and also a solution to the problem. Because as I'll explain to you later, we Jews have accepted that. We've never rebelled against. Modern man, when I say modern man, perhaps the word modern is not fitting, because it goes back to the Greeks of old. The tradition which, it's an old tradition which modern man has accepted as the point of departure for his world outlook and Weltanschauung. Modern man rejects the finiteness awareness. He does not look upon himself as if he were engulfed in Mimamakim. He does not look upon himself as if he were, so to say, in the straits. All exits sealed. No one to help him to get to the land, or to get his freedom. Modern man wants to be more than he is in reality. He attempts to overreach himself. He wants to achieve vastness, boundlessness. He resents boundaries in general. He wants to disobey stop signs and to rush toward infinity. Particularly, modern man hates defeat. He cannot take defeat. Neither the individual nor the community can take defeat. Can our country take defeat in Vietnam? It can't. When people storm the gates of the White House, They don't understand that it's humanly impossible to take defeat. Defeat is imposed upon a human being. He never accepts it voluntarily. That's why America cannot just get out of Vietnam. It's not a political statement, it's a metaphysical statement. So this comes. Hates, as I said before, he hates defeat. And particularly, he hates, not only hates, he's horrified by the prospect of meeting with defeat in death. He hates death. In this welter of frustrating feelings, anxieties, and fears, all of them revolving around finiteness of man in terms of time, around his final destiny, about the absurdity of living, while knowing that one is headed toward the grave, which puts an end to all human inspirations, visions, and commitments, it becomes necessary for modern man to reach for salvation, some salvation. No matter how illusory, no matter how short-lived, and no matter how deceitful. In fact, all experiments to cure man, not of measles, but of his metaphysical awareness of finiteness, of his fear of death, are simply absurd, because he never can be cured of that. But modern man wants to cure himself. He wants to redeem himself without appealing to God for redemption, for salvation. Of course, and I wish to stay there. Of course, that modern man tries to defeat death scientifically through medicine, this is praiseworthy. Iadus has always approved of scientific medicine. Iadus has never faced the problem which Christianity did. How is one allowed for me to cure himself? Christianity still has not overcome his difficulty. Iadus has accepted medicine, the scientific art of healing, as something natural and indispensable. I am speaking now about men trying to forget about his finiteness through a way of life. Two paths. Are open to frightened man, and man is a frightened being. Mother man more frightened than men of all. To frightened man. Interesting that the point of departure is the same. Yet, the path leads to opposite objectives. The point of departure is a simple one. The death experience or the fear of nothingness, or you may say the finiteness awareness, as the psalmist calls it, Mimamaki, is inextricably intertwined with the I exist awareness. One has to pass through the light of the existential awareness, of the I exist awareness, in order to get to the chilling darkness of non-being, of the grave. If one could stay forever in the beneficent twilight of a non-reflective, please listen carefully, of a non-reflective, matter-of-fact being, without soul searching, without meditating, without trying to equate being with knowing, and without subscribing to the old idea that real is only who knows himself to be real. If men could do it, in other words, if one could suspend or at least dim, obscure, the I exist awareness, he would not have to be burdened with the fear of death or the finiteness awareness or the awareness of imperfection or incompleteness. But the question rose immediately, how can one suspend or at least eclipse a bit the I exist awareness? Because when a man enjoys his being in existence, then he begins to think of the other, of the opposite destiny of his. The answer was, first, by abandoning the moral norm which is implied in the finite I exist awareness. In the finite I exist awareness, there is a moral norm. I exist for a certain time, for a very short time. My span of life is limited, and I am burdened with a task which I have to accomplish during that short span of life. In the I exist, there is another awareness implies, I exist and I am duty-bound to utilize or take advantage of my existence to make my contribution. I'll speak later about it. Yes. There is a moral norm. The moral law is intuitively implied in the I exist awareness. I cross this valley only once, and while I'm on my journey through this world, I should leave my mark, and I should leave traces. I should accomplish something. So first of all, if one wants to abandon the moral norm implied in the I exist awareness, then he'll dim the awareness. The awareness will not be as intense and as overpowering. But how do you abandon the moral norm? It's simply by intoxication or drunkenness. I don't mean intoxication with alcohol or drunkenness with whiskey, but actually by intoxicating oneself. By the rapturous, hypnotic, hedonic experience. You know what hedonic is, what pleasure experience. Not as nice as hedonic. Which overpowers man and which takes him out of the world of flowing time, of prospection and anticipation. For orgiastic man, time is reduced to one dimension, the present moment. Of course, the obscuration of the I exist awareness and the surrender to Hedonai, which is exciting and perplexing, is a result in the loss of rationality. Man is disciplined, courageous, and resent deceit. He wants to stay in the illumined spot, even though by enjoying the dazzling light, will have to cast a glance into the yawning abyss of horrors. Rational man does not escape from reality, notwithstanding the fact, the unpleasant fact, that the reality he must encounter, the final reality he must encounter, is death. Rational man experiences being as a normative moral affair. I exist in order to accomplish. Orgiastic man forms the aesthetic society, the orgiastic society, whose prime objective is to enjoy and not to be aware either of being or non-being. The hedonic society is non-reflective, non-meditating, non-introspective, non-self-appraising, or self-searching. The hedonic society is more or less a democratic society. This is the Western society. In pursuit of pleasure and happiness. And that society, if you want to break down its world philosophy, its world outlook, its Weltanschauung into its component parts. So this democratic society is in pursuit of pleasure, insists on minimum government interference in private life, through, resents controls, demands unrestricted freedom in matters which don't affect the community, particularly matters of sex morality, hates discipline imposed from above, not even by teachers, is opposed to any draft, to any conscription, and does not like to pay high taxes. The motto of the orgiastic society, or call it as hedonic, if you have mercy on the society. I call it orgiastic society, because our society is orgiastic in the manner. The orgiastic society, the motto of the orgiastic society was formulated long ago. How long ago, would you say? How long ago? In Kol Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. The Yippies and the Hippies did not discover anything. How long ago, what do you say? Huh? Since when? Of course they're Dora Mabel. It's almost antediluvian. Vayiru b'nei olekim es b'nei sorodom ki tevei seno vayikhu lehem noshim mekeil asher bokoru. And the sons of the mighty, so the daughters of men, they are fair, and they took them to wives, whomsoever they chose. What should be emphasized, underlined in that statement, in that verse? What would you underline? Of course, the Mekeila Shabachorum. What the Torah underlines is the phrase, not the liked fair woman. This itself wouldn't be so bad. for the freedom from any normative system interfering with human hedonism. No authority, this worldly or transcendental, may legislate how men should enjoy life. As long, of course, that they'll admit, as long as it does not infringe upon the rights of others. Orgiastic man does not only respond willfully, enthusiastically, to inevitable biological urges. This wouldn't be bad. Whose fulfillment yields pleasure, but experiments with the idea and how to precipitate new pressures and unheard of, newly contrived artificial situations which should challenge the body to respond by engaging in gratifying action which is completely unnecessary. In short, our Western society is the typical representative of the aesthetic society, which actually originated, the real founder of the aesthetic society. Who is the real founder? You speak about founding fathers. Who is the, here it happens to be a founding mother. Who is she? Father, of course. Vatero isho keteva eitz lemacho, vichitavo hiro enoim, venechmotzei eitz lehaskil, vatikach mitpiryei va... Vatero. In that moment, Western society was founded and incorporated. Actually, the one who took the charter out for the hedonic society was Eve. To tell you that the Torah hated orgiastic men, not only resented, hated, abhorred, is unnecessary. And the censure or the rebuke against orgiastic men or hedonic society was formulated in the Torah where? Where? Where you say? No. That side. People sit on my right. I mean, I believe the rebuke or hedonic life was censured in the 10th commandment. Thou shalt not covet, shalt not desire something which is beyond your reach. One must not stretch out his hand. For sense infinity, spiritual infinity is great. Sense infinity is corrupting and abominable. For carnal boundlessness, for the vastness that the flesh demands of man. The Torah did condone a pleasant, happy and gracious life, provided that enjoyment is bounded. And the call of the blood is moderate. One may pursue pleasure according to our viewpoint if he knows how and when to retreat and withdraw. How many times did the Torah, how many times did hedonic society come to the foreground, to the surface, as far as the accounts of the Pentateuch are concerned. How many times had the Pentateuch recorded the emergence of hedonic society into the historical biblical arena? How many times? I believe 4 times. Orgiastic men appeared, and God, who is patient and kind and benevolent, punished him severely. Of course, the first was Eve. The second, of course, the orgiastic society, orgiastic men of Deir Hamabul. Now the third, where's the third? Huh? I can't hear you. Zdom was about Zdom will speak later. They deserve special attention. I don't believe that Zdom belongs to the group, that Zdom society was orgiastic or perhaps, but not. Ah? Kivrotatavo! The people in the desert, when they shouted and demanded flesh, meat, quail, they were overcome by lust. And the wind from the Lord started up, swept quail from the sea, and threw them over the camp. And the people sat together in quail all the day and night. The meat was still between their teeth when the anger of the Lord blazed forth. And finally, a fourth time, the famous Baal Pe'er episode by Yochel Om Lisnes as Bnei Smeog, the people began to commit adultery with the Moabite women. And now I wish to emphasize something. When I speak of orgiastic men or the hedonic society, I'm not referring exclusively to carnal hedone, to real hedone of the flesh, like gluttony or promiscuity. I don't refer it exclusively. I don't refer to what is known in medieval scholastics, and I always find it hard to pronounce, as concupiscence. You know what it is? I don't. It's lust, more or less it's lust. It's more or less it's something very bad anyway. As a matter of fact, and let us be truthful, Western world is addicted to this strange, let me see again, concupiscence. Western world is lusty, is in pursuit for pleasures of the flesh. The whole sex morality, so-called sex morality, of the campuses, I mean, can attest to what I say. Western world is addicted to this kind of hedonism. Many European, and I may say, I mean, not my patriotism should not, I'm a patriot, but an American, but many European, particularly Scandinavian countries, have reached absolute proportion in their liberality and legislation pertaining to sex morals or sex habits. However, when I say hedonoi, and this is true even in the old, in the sense of the Greek term, when I say hedonoi, I refer to human questing for all goods of the senses. If the element of boundlessness or the drive for infinity, for vastness, or the element of overreaching oneself, of trying to grab more than I can consume, is present. Whenever the fantasy, because it's an aesthetic experience, it's also an experience, a fantastic experience, whenever the fantasy begins to stimulate man and to stir in him unqualified yearning for the finite goods of sense. They are good, but they are finite, and they are not goods of the spirit, they are goods of the sense. Be it money, be it large estate, be it lust, sex lust, be it delicious food, be it social prominence, so-called publicity. Wherever desire, unlimited desire rises, orgiastic man emerges into the arena. The miser, even the miser, kind of a miser described by Gogol, whatever, who keeps on piling up golden coins, without spending a nickel on himself, starving, dressed in rags, is also, in a funny way, orgiastic. He belongs also to the hedonic society. For he cannot satiate his hunger for gold. And if there is no satiety, then man is orgiastic. Whether orgiastic man is industrialist or thinker or a Casanova or Napoleon or even a great scientist, doesn't matter. What is important? That their imagination weaves a halo around goods, finite, a halo of infinity, around finite goods of sense. And they find, they are mistaken, but they think they have found self-fulfillment in finite goods of sense. And tell me now, isn't the Western society, the hedonic society, who tries to find self-fulfillment in the finite goods of sense? There is another society, because there's another path, I told you, which human beings take in order to escape from the finiteness awareness, in order to engage in self-deceit, not only in an illusion, but simply in a delusion. The second path, along which frightened man, modern man, travels in his wild flight, from finiteness, death leads, as I have said before, in the opposite direction. instead of dimming, while orgiastic man dims his awareness, his I exist, and I must accomplish awareness. Instead of dimming the I exist awareness and surrendering to sensuous rapture of living, men attempt to enhance and to exalt his I exist awareness. Men at this stage, traveling along the second path, tries to overcome the fear of finiteness through a big lie. You know, the method of the big lie was initiated, you know, by Goebbels, taken over by Khrushchev, transmitted, people may see, I'm sorry, Yeshua, transmitted to Brezhnev, little by little handed down to Western society as well. Through the big lie, through convincing himself that he is more than man, through intentionally magnifying 100-fold and exaggerating and lying about human ability and power to solve both scientific and metaphysical problems of humanity, by simply painting in iridescent colors, in the eschatological age, which will be brought about by man alone, through his wisdom and creative effort. I believe that you know what I'm referring to. In a word, man wants to defeat, who travels along the second path, wants to defeat his anxiety concerning death, his finiteness, through setting himself up as a deity, powerful, wise, and creative. The awareness, I exist, expanding to a larger awareness, I do exist, as creator, as mighty ruler, legislator, and final authority. And something happens. I mean, whoever, of course, I mean, this method has been employed by all humanists. I mean, those humanists who wanted to replace transcendental morality with man-made morality. It's certainly true of the Marxist world outlook. To say that Marxism has taken an optimistic approach to man does not suffice. They adore man, not only admire, but adore. And they not only idealize man, but they idolize man. And by idolizing man, setting him up as a deity, no wonder that there is simple, that a certain idolatrous cult develops there from time to time, like the cult of Lenin, I mean, of Stalin, the present cult of Lenin, the cult of Mao Zedong, and so forth and so on. I mean, because basically, fundamentally, they try to overcome human finiteness, human imperfection, by idolizing themselves. Of course, if I call, I mean, it was hard to find a proper term how to describe that man. I call him arrogant man, I believe it's good. Arrogant man who wants to erase his finiteness experience through self-idolization, his attention, he must shift his attention from the individual to the society, from the single person to the group, to mankind, because to idolize the individual would be nonsensical, would be absurd. The latter, society, mankind, humanity, is idolized, deified, and set up as the omnipotent deity. For humanity as such, no single individual, will, in the opinion of self-sufficient, arrogant man, redeem itself from bondage. Only mankind itself can accomplish, can liberate itself. The idol is the class, not the individual. Of course, the individual who is idolized is the image of the class. He is, so to say, the substitute for the class. He represents the class. But through Lenin, through Mao Zedong, and through Stalin, the class was idolized. This arrogant society is unfortunately not pleasure sick. Oh no, not at all. On the contrary, an ascetic streak runs through this society. In the name of some doctrine or code, man-made of course, they appeal for sacrifices. They are norm conscious, in contradistinction to Western man, who abandons norms. They are norm conscious and duty oriented. Western man has forgotten what duty means. In the name of a doctrine, on behalf of the ethical code, which was legislated by man, they are out to conquer or destroy the world. There is no third option to them. There is no third alternative. The human made norm is ultimate. Every human formulated doctrine becomes a credo, an article of faith, whose cogency must not be doubted. And woe to the writer who doubts the absolute cogency and veracity of a Marxist doctrine. So, in other words, arrogant man becomes a tyrant. And the society turns, an arrogant society that he establishes, turns it into a tyrannical society. The tyrannical arrogant society is bold and aggressive, trampling upon individual freedom and personal dignity. The arrogant society scoffs at human faith in God and considers faith in a transcendental existence as a human weakness. Arrogant man is well organized, disciplined. Their undertakings are bold in design and daring in execution. Did such a society exist? In people, of course, the day after, of course. Arrogant, tyrannical society was portrayed in Chumash by the day after. It's a very strange generation it was. Let me just read two verses from the Chumash. And they said to one another, come, let us make brick and burned them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in heaven. It is hard sometimes to identify whose words we just read. Are they the words spoken by fanatical, vainglorious men of old of antiquity, or by some communist leader of today? Arrogant man, while orgiastic man is non-rational, arrogant man is irrational. Why? Why? And I want you to understand, non-rational man means simply a man who simply has cast off, shed his rationality. Irrational man means a man who has a rationality, but a funny one. Irrationality is very rational, I want you to know. There is reasonableness to irrationality. There is no reasonableness to non-rationality. But there is system, there is continuity, there is unity, there is consistency to irrationality. Non-rational man rejects norms. Non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendental law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive. He's not satanic. He's not that. Non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendental law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive, is not satanic, is not diabolical. He's simply a fool. Rational man, orgiastic man, hates evil. He certainly does hate evil, even though he lacks the instrument to check it. Because there is one instrument to check evil. This is the transcendental law. By rejecting the transcendental law, man has lost the instrument in which he could check evil. Arrogant man is irrational because he is satanic, diabolical. He legislates norms, defines doctrines, formulates articles of faith, and ascribes to all those irrational things ultimate worth. There is something else. Irrational man may write, not only may write, he had written already a code of immorality. Immorality itself becomes a norm. Murder may turn into a noble deed within the frame of reference of irrationality. Nazi Germany is the best example. Many who killed Jews, who burned Jews in the crematoria, thought that they are actually accomplishing something. That they are conforming to a great moral norm and are implementing the moral law. While agnosticism is non-rational, metaphysical arrogance, which leads to idolatry, results is irrational because it is evil. And again, the Torah abhorred arrogant man. Who was the first arrogant man who wanted, so to say, to replace God, or to play God, or a late claim on ultimate validity of doctrine, law, and all? This one, I don't know what he was, but was quite clever and capable. This was our old friend, the serpent, Noach HaShakadmeni. Quite capable. And he told Eve, Ki yedei alikim v'yimachochem emenu, v'nifkechu eneichem, v'yitzem kelekim yedei vora. The job of man is to replace the Almighty. Nasir lo migdol v'reishi v'ashamayim. This is evil itself. And again, the Torah has forbidden arrogance, metaphysical arrogance. Where? While Adonai was forbidden by the 10th commandment, metaphysical arrogance was forbidden by the 1st commandment. Onechi ad Hashem lekecho, liyoloch elohim acherim al ponai. And the incarnation, the personification of irrationality, of arrogance, which is evil, is who? Noach HaShem just said. But Noach HaShem, if we had him around, we could settle our account with him, but he's not around. That's what we understand. And by the concept Amalek. That at least what the Chachmei HaKabbalah or the Kabbalists have understood. Not a Bedouin tribe, not a race, but evil. Man Satan, who writes a code to kill and to oppress and to lie. That's Amalek. And here, something strange happens. The Torah has portrayed orgiastic man, an arrogant man, through two societies. The Deir Mabu, orgiastic man and arrogant man, and their societies, the aesthetic, and the arrogant tyrannical society, by introducing two generations. As a rule, even though the Torah did it, and the Torah meant to do it in order to show the transition, as a rule, orgiastic society succumbs to tyrannical, arrogant society. I would even say, orgiastic society gradually, little by little, piecemeal, turns into a tyrannical, arrogant society. A pleasure-loving aesthete is ready prey to the intrigue, to the scheming of power-hungry satanic mind. He's too much involved, the orgiastic man, with himself. All his talents are consecrated to the goods. His imagination sees objects of his desire, nothing else. He doesn't see people. He has no historical sensitivity. Hedonic man lacks historical intuition. He cannot behold historical visions. He's too much involved in the present. He's too much absorbed in hedonism. The non-rational orgiastic man lacks historical intuition, sensitivity to events. He doesn't feel the heartbeat of history. He's much absorbed in his hedonic experiences. You overemphasize foolishly the ideal of freedom that happened in 1970 in Russia If Kerensky had had a little bit of intelligence, the whole communist revolution wouldn't have taken place. He overemphasizes the importance of freedom. He simply lacks the courage, the vision, and the power of anticipation. He lacks the predictive element in history. He does not experience history, since he lives just for the present. And little by little, his power is eroded, and he is replaced by the irrational man, who is time-conscious and future. That happened in Germany, and I was there so many years ago, in the late 20s, in the early 30s, another indulgent, permissive, hedonic, drunk society, and the society in our country now is tolerated, even promoted the rise to power of a tyrant, a madman. He was not, and the madman was not non-rational. Had he been that, he would have never lasted one day. Wouldn't have lasted one day. He was irrational, with a peculiar, demonic, diabolical logic and weird thinking. He was dedicated to an absolute norm of his own making, the norm of immorality. And the same thing happens in the Western world, where the so-called youth movement, rejecting all norms, every semblance of regulated, self-limiting life, and preaching boundless liberty, freedom from all authority, are actually blazing the trail for irrational men to come and to take over. And the same happened in the time of Ahasuerus. What do we see when the curtain rises on the first act of Megillas Esther? What do we see? What do we see on the stage? What do you see? A feasting, pleasure-loving, and pleasure-pursuing society. The Book of Esther did not spare words in portraying vividly, with refined artistry and sarcasm, the repugnant addiction of the king, the princess, courtiers, and servants to lascivious pleasures, to the incessant pursuit of an ever-fugitive satisfaction, the habits of an orgiastic society that was tired and exhausted because of satiety, and yet anticipated another satiety to be tried for the sheer novelty of it, is clearly portrayed. Why was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the eunuchs, the names of the harem keepers, Shashgas, Hegoi, the brands of cosmetics used by the king's concubines, the foul and lewd habits of the king himself, the scripture which is so tight-lipped about the lives of Moses and Abraham, became suddenly so loquacious in narrating the story of the king's wives, banquets, and the degenerate life at court? The answer is simple, because only in a such non-rational environment could irrational men Satan rise. Only people who were pleasure-pursuing had no fixity, no fixed norms, no ultimate validity, no doctrine. Everything was shifting like these sand dunes could tolerate a man Satan, irrational and destructive and cruel. Only people addicted to the beautiful and pleasant could stand by and watch the smoke rising from the crematoria chimneys climbing to heaven. Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh. Do you know how this bloody nonsense happened? Because it was Achashverosh era, born of hedonism and freedom from the moral norm. Vayhi achar hadvarim haeleh, in the society of Shashgas in Hegoi must produce a Hymen. It was true so many years ago, it is true today as well. Now, if you are not tired nor bored, I would like to tell you what is the Jewish approach to the finiteness awareness. How do we handle that? We saw our modern man handles in two different ways. In an arrogant way and an hedonic way. Of course, Yehadus, as I said before, objects to the two solutions which orgiastic and arrogant tyrannical men suggested. Yehadus asserts that the mamakim awareness can never be cast off. Never. Never. Woe is to the man who tries to shed off the mamakim awareness. Can never be cast off, suppressed, or changed by man. The latter must abandon those childish satisfactions, the hedonism and the big lies. Make, reconcile with the finiteness awareness and abolish all taints of spiritual gluttony. And Yehadus developed, in my opinion, four aspects of the finiteness awareness. There are four dimensions to the finiteness awareness. First of all, the metaphysical dimension. Man cannot and must not attempt to suspend the finiteness awareness, for the latter is interwoven into the texture of the I exist experience. Hence, man alone is unable to free himself from all the symptoms of that awareness, such as the feeling of loneliness, boredom, frustration, anguish, fear. Man is certainly incapable to defeat death. Salvation of man can come only from God. His companionship will heal man from the anxiety of being incomplete, finite, and transient. It is principle number one. Science will never solve the metaphysical problem of man. And all my respect to the psychiatrist will never heal man from the finiteness awareness or from the experience of ma'amakim or minameitza kovasiko. Never! And don't listen to the beautiful, so to say, beautiful exposés and lectures delivered usually by non-scientists, by platitudinous people, about these prospects of psychiatry and the knowledge and the science of the mental processes of man, that they will solve the existential problem of man, never in their life. Because solve the metaphysical, I'm not speaking about psychiatric problems. I want you to know, insanity is a psychiatric problem. Metaphysics does not know insanity. But metaphysical problems of man, who express themselves psychologically in a variety of manifestations, in a variety of aspects, can never be cured by man. Only salvation from God. Certainly not fear of death, nor death itself can be eliminated by man. I don't believe that medicine will at any time, 1,000 years from now, reach the stage at which it will be able to turn man into an immortal being. Of course, we believe in immortality, and we also believe that someday, even psychosomatic man will be immortal. But only when it will be God's will to do so, you are modest in Netzach, Mokad, Hashem, Dibu, Mal, Kopani. Second, the Hadus believes that exploration of the entire universe, of the universe in its outskirts and its fringes, exploration of the boundless stretches and gray uncharted plains of the astral world will never be completed. Yes, Yehadus has encouraged men to explore, to conquer, to rule. The latter may explore limited astral sectors, even the entire solar system, and if he wants to believe and to dream, he may even make a trip. I don't know how long it will take, but according to what physicists say, in keeping with Einstein theory, if a young man will start out for a star in a different system, and he'll come back home, he'll be as young as he was on the day of departure. All right? The only question is whether he'll come back home. But however, yes. And I don't believe in it. I'll even say that we'll be able to get out of our galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy, and reach another galaxy. But this is just a small corner in the universe. The entire universe will remain an unknown mystery. The boundless uncharted lanes of the dark spaces and galaxies will remain closed to man. The reason for this is a simple one, because man is finite, and who knows where the universe is. And finite men cannot explore infinity and boundlessness. Number two. Now scientism, not scientism, but pseudoscientism, has become a religion for many, a cult. It's just as idolatrous as the cult of Stalin and Mao Zedong. And just as foolish. Third. Man will never find the answer to the mysterium magnum question. How does the universe function? You'll never answer that question. Man has accomplished a great deal with his quantifying mathematical method. However, he just establishes abstract relationships answering the how question from within, without answering the why question from without. That will remain a secret. The mysterium magnum, mysterium tremendum, will never be resolved. Unless, and God will the eschatological age to commence. Fourth, men cannot and men must not legislate the moral norm. Men should be either ready to accept morality from God or give up any attempt to live a moral life. Because imposition of a secular code, secular, finite, and relative code upon society is in vain and is worthless. In my opinion, that's exactly what the original sin, the Chet HaKadmon, consisted of. Adam tried to do it, to impose, to legislate norms of good and bad, and brought disaster upon himself and mankind. Irrational man does it. with arrogance, and he ends up with the law, with the moral law of immorality. Lahashmi lahare velave. So Judaism has accepted all four major aspects, and those four major aspects are four ma'amakim, the ma'amakim consciousness, as unalterable God-willed inevitable experiences of defeat. Judaism, it's very important, has spoken so beautifully of Tchilas V'Lovan. Very strange that our tzitzis consist of two colors, Tchilas V'Lovan, white and blue. What kind of blue? The Rambam says, blue at noon, the color of the sky at noontime, dazzling, light blue, dazzling, white blue. Rashi says, it is the color of the evening sky, dark blue, bordering on the black. And it's quite interesting that when the Mishnah asked the question, when is the one supposed to read Shema? So the answer is, Mishiyakir ben Tchilas V'Lavan, when he is ready to discriminate, or is able to discriminate, between blue and white. Discriminate where? So Tesis quotes a Yerushalmi, you should just pull out his tzitzis and try to discriminate between one or two threads of blue, or four threads of blue, and the white threads. What is the white color? The white color in Hebrew language, in Hebrew semantics, is the symbol of plainness, simplicity, intelligibility, and familiarity, friendship. If you want to say it is clear, it is certain, it's undoubt, it is without, it is, there is no doubt about it, doubtless, you say Kashemesh Batzorayim. It says, as the dazzling light coming upon us from the heavens. When the Raivet disagrees with the Rambam, and rebukes him, he says, Lenoyer, Letzoyer, Leboyer. There is no light, there is no whiteness, it's dark. What does the Tchilas color represent in Yehadus? The Gemara asked, and the Gemara answered, Tchilas Deima Leyam, the blue color is reminiscent of the large sea, of the immense vastness of the sea, Yam Deina Lerokia, the sea reflects the blueness of the sky, the Rokia Deina Lekisya Koveit, and the sky, the heavens, reflect the glory of the celestial throne, of the transcendental Ribbono Shel Olam. Tchilas color, what did the Gemara want to express by it? The Tchilas color reflect distance, remoteness, beyond reach, the vast expanse of the sea, and the boundless astral distances. It reflects impenetrable mystery, enveloping the destiny of man, the tremor and fear inspired by the incursion from time to time of the unknown, transcendent into our lives. And it happens quite often. Yehadus warned man not to be too sure of himself, not to be overconfident, not to be too cocky, if you want to say it, and not to be over-sophisticated, too clever. And the others kept on telling us, and this runs like a red thread throughout our literature, from antiquity until the Sifre, to the Sifre Musa of contemporary scholars. There are intelligible factors in reality which are flooded with the white dazzling light. Everything in those sectors is clear, understandable, and intimate. In those sectors one enjoys warmth and sweetness. However, there are also sectors enveloped in the dark blue of the mysterious evening sky, where man feels like a homeless wanderer who just happened to cross into a strange, foreboding territory. The transition from one sector, from the white sector, to another is quick and sudden. Chilas of the evening sky replaces Lovon of the bright day unexpectedly. How was it that the night of the Yotet of Mar? How was it 7 years ago? We don't try to invest to explore our own experiences. How was it? It was very simple. I was enjoying the bright day of my life, full of color and sun. Three years had passed since I went through a serious abdominal operation, and God helped me to recover from that illness. There was, Baruch Hashem, no recurrence. It seemed to me as if everything was going to be simple, white, and magnificent, like the dazzling light of the noon sky, and that I'll be able to study Torah, mitoch osher, of course, with an aleph, not with an ayin. And the same evening, she told me, I have to enter the hospital for just observation. And suddenly the bright day, in a matter of minutes, turned into a dark, bleak, dreary, autumnal night. Transition from love to tears is a very quick and abrupt one. How was it in Shushan? Habira. A day before, they feasted, Jew and Gentile, courtier and Ish Yehudi, together drank toast and hugged each other. In a matter of hours, the pistols were sent out with the couriers, lehashmid, leharik, lehabeit, to destroy, to slay, and to kill. Yahadus says, I'm sorry, it's contrary to the American philosophy of pursuit of happiness. I'm sorry, I have to be an Epicurus as far as the Declaration of Independence is concerned. You'll excuse me, I mean, we have in our yeshiva people who watch for it, of course, it. Watch out for it. I beg mercy, I should not be included among those at the crossing. Pursuit of happiness contradicts the finiteness awareness. And the finiteness awareness in Yahadus expresses itself in one word, man's insecurity vis-à-vis the future. Because man is a being who lives in time. He does not live in the present moment. The present moment is only a link. He lives in the past. And he lives in the future. He remembers the past and anticipates the future. He feels nostalgia as far as the past is concerned. It's a devastating nostalgia. Many things he could have accomplished, and he didn't. I would give my right arm, to use a colloquialism, if I could just speak for 5 minutes. With one of the 3 people I just lost 3 years ago. Just for 5 minutes. I tried to speak to them, standing at their graves. Today I stood at her grave. I addressed myself there. There was no answer. Or perhaps the answer was lost, I don't know. I couldn't hear. This is the nostalgia for something that was within my reach, and I did not exploit the opportunity. I did not take advantage of it. I call this kind of nostalgia Merochei Kadeshem Nirvei. One begins to appreciate God when he is at a distance from him, remote. When God is very close, orgiastic man doesn't appreciate it. Nostalgia is a part of the human mima makim, but then there is insecurity in the future. I tried to gain a glimpse in the future. Only fools can speak of security, unless they identify security with the stock market. And it's a very bad equation now. But what do you mean man's security? I always say, now I move my finger, my index finger. Whether I'll be able to move the finger 5 minutes from now, God knows, I don't know. And Chazal has considered every morning the man wakes up and stands on his feet as the day of Trias Amazim. Because unconscious men regain this consciousness. The miracle of Trias Amazim in miniature, according to Chazal, happens and occurs every morning when sleeping man, unconscious man, wakes up and regains his awareness. I do exist, and my existence has a purpose, most probably. Man's insecurity, this is actually the word which expresses in total the finiteness, awareness, the mina meitza, as he called, or mima makim kvasich v'adishem. And man's insecurity lies at the very root of prayer. Without the finiteness awareness, without man's insecurity, there would be no prayer. The latter is the response to human misery stemming from the mima makim awareness. Let me just explain to you in short. Prayer, whether of biblical or rabbinic origin, doesn't matter now. We don't have to engage in the controversy between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether prayer is medraise or medrabana. But, korosiko, tfilelelonikiyatev, kele kele lomaz aftones, the chapter which Esther recited when she was about to enter the royal court. Only then is prayer meaningful. When he dawns upon man, and mother man is too foolish, and he is not conscious of it, that his situation is a tragic one, that he is utterly defeated, that there is nobody to help him but God. Prayer and crisis are inexplicably linked up. Of course, the question rises immediately. If the crisis awareness is indispensable for prayer, How can prayer be recited daily? At times of peace and prosperity and success and victory, how can I say Rufa'inu Ad Hashem Ben Arofe if I just this morning, came from the doctor, gave me his thorough checkup, and gave me what we call it in colloquial English, a clean bill of health. So what sense does the Rufa'inu have? And what sense does the Baruch Aleinu, the same Baruch of the Adomo have, if I have a fat bank account in the bank? Does it have a sense or doesn't it have a sense? Apparently it has a sense. What is the sense? In insecurity of man. Now I'm healthy. How I'll feel next morning, I don't know. There is future and present linked up. And this is the idea of prayer. And this lies at the root of the idea of prayer, the finiteness awareness of man. It is his nostalgia, devastating, completely unreal. He wants something which he can never get. He wants contact with the world which is gone long ago. He wants communication, communion with persons who are not here around anymore. They are far, far away. He wants many things because he was a fool. He missed them while they were around. He could just have, all he had to do is to stretch out his arm. He could have reached them. And insecurity of man. The second aspect of crisis, of the finiteness awareness. Of the Mamakim Umina Meitzer. Now let me just finish. However, prayer in Yehadus, I want you to understand it, is not just a recital. It is more than that. It is a world outlook, and it is also a way of life. Because prayer, what is the term, the halachic term for prayer? Tefillah is all right, of course, but there's another term. The prime term for prayer, Aveda Shevalev. Aveda means, if you work, if you translate prayer into your daily life, into deeds. Of course, we said that prayer is the answer which Yehadus gives, or the response of Yehadus to the Mimamakim or Minameitzer awareness. The question is, yes, it is the answer. The insecurity of man, when I am with God, I feel secure. And that's why, in my great agony and misery of a period, not 3 years, but almost seven years, I found companionship in the Torah. I've never learned as much as I did the last 7 years. Because I felt, while I studied, I've been studying, that someone behind me, stands behind me, casting a furtive glance, leaning over my shoulder, and casting a furtive glance into the blood Gemara, and silently asking me, what are you studying? And that awareness of unseen presence has kept me, has guided me, has made me survive, physically, intellectually, and emotionally. Prayer is not enough. There must be a way of life which is prayerful, saturated with the idea of prayer, permeated with the philosophy of prayer and the metaphysic of prayer. What is the way of life which prayer reflects? Let me tell you that here. I'll finish. A prayerful life signifies first a consecrated life. Yehadus believes the TH man, I mentioned it last year, but I'm developing it in a different fashion. Yahadus believed that each man has an assignment. A man is not born, is not cast, as the existentialists say, into this world in vain, for no purpose, for no reason. He's burdened with an assignment. Each man, in the opinion of Yahadus, is anointed, not appointed. Appointed, yes, but even anointed by the Almighty to contribute something to redemption, to the arrival of the eschatological age, to the great redemption. In other words, a drop of the holy oil, Shemen HaMishre, of consecration, fell on the head of every Jew. He is called to participate in the great march of generations who have been blazing the trail for the Melech HaMashiach since the dawn of our history. Each Jew is the herald, the harbinger of the Melech HaMashiach. All is, a Melech HaMashiach in miniature, all by himself, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach. Each Jew has a messianic, eschatological assignment. And each Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking. To serve. God has laid claim on me. Or of the Melech HaMashiach. All is a Melech HaMashiach in miniature, all by himself, because he blazes the trail for the great Melech HaMashiach. Each Jew has a messianic, eschatological assignment. And each Jew should think, I was born for one purpose only. This is the prayerful way of thinking. To serve. God has laid claim on me. Or does lay claim on me. He wants me for his service. It's a plain pasuk in Israel. The old Jewish hymn, which has been echoing through the millennia and centuries, certainly says that man belongs to God. If entire creation is his property, so man, Allah has come of it, come up. And if he belongs to God, so he is consecrated to the service of God. He is a Messiah in miniature. And when I speak of service, I mean two kinds of service. One service is the continuous one. Life itself is a service. Takadish Baruch Hu. If man knows how to live, if man knows how to plot his course, if a man knows how to respond to experiences, if man knows how to pray and how to treat his fellow man, this itself is a service. However, there is another service, a one-timely service, which in times of emergency, when a special urgent appeal addressed by God to man, reaches him. Such an appeal, you know very well, was addressed, and perhaps my wife used to say, this is the gist of the entire Megillas Esther, was addressed to Esther. Such an appeal. It was just one timely, in a crisis, in an emergency situation, was an appeal addressed to Esther. Lover lifnei ha-melech, el ha-melech ulevakish milfon avalamo. Such an appeal was addressed to Abraham, even though Abraham's life in its entirety was a service to God, was consecrated. But no one can get away from the one timely appeal, which begins to echo through the uncharted spaces, separating us from the Almighty. Kachlo es bincho es echitcho es yitzcho kasher avto. Such a petition is submitted to each individual once in a life. The service which individual is called upon to perform is singular, which only he, the individual to whom the appeal was addressed, is capable of rendering. No one else can do the job which Dashkoch has assigned to him. The service requested of Esther was of a singular nature, and according to Mordechai's philosophy, Esther, who was born and made queen in order she should perform one service which took her just a couple of hours. Umi yedea im leis kozeis gadat lamalchus. Who knows whether thou art not come to the royal estate for such a time as this? I would just add two words. And who knows if you hadn't been born just for that purpose? And who knows if God hadn't bestowed beauty and charm upon you just for that purpose? The time has come. The call was sounded. Esther responded. This is one prayerful way of life. Of course, there's a second aspect to it. A messianic consecrated life, a life of service, is ipso facto a courageous life. It's a courageous life. What does a courageous life mean? I would rather use the term heroic life. It's a heroic life. And I have been saying it for a long time. If someone should ask me, what does Yahadus want of us? I would give him one answer. To live heroically. To live courageously. To live his fortitude. Heroic life, Yahadus disliked cowardice. Yahadus had contempt. I wouldn't say dislike, had contempt. For a mercantile logic, the logic of a businessman. I am not present company excluded if there is some businessman in the audience. The businessman logic, the pragmatic utilitarian logic, which is too astute and too cautious, and which tells man that he must not begin unless he knows for sure that he is able to finish. Courageous life or heroic action is based fundamentally motivated not by pragmatic utilitarian, mercantile, discursive, logical reasoning, because this reasoning is at best a coward, deplorous. But is motivated, but is inspired rather by intuitive insights, by spiritual perceptions which are beyond the reach of the logical formal analysis. As a matter of fact, the most important decision, this is true of every man, Jew and non-Jew alike, the most important decisions in one's life are reached in the intuitive rather than in the logical dimension. The Jew of old, the fine woman, and the Jew of today, who has to do the same job, to define not only one woman, but the entire world, is not guided by syllogistic inferences. Because had he been very guided by those inferences, he would never dare to defy the world, to confront the world. Had he made an inquiry of the strictly practical, a bit pompous logos, he would have received an answer in the negative. From the logical, rational viewpoint, those relations, those rebellions, this defiance, this type of confrontation is plainly suicidal. Mordechai's defiance of Haman was suicidal. Esther's risking her life, and with it, the lives of millions of Jews, was logically unwarranted. She did, because as Chazal said, the Spirit of God has descended upon her. She was inspired. And in conclusion, a courageous life, a service life, dedicated to service, means a heroic life. A heroic life means sacrificial life. And the highest form of sacrifice for a human being is not to give his life. No. The highest form of sacrifice, the way Yehadus has understood it, is his readiness to leave the stage after he had played his part assigned to him and vanish in anonymity and oblivion. More than a person wants to live, a person wants to be remembered. Remembered by individuals, remembered by society, remembered that he has accomplished something. This quest for being remembered, for not being forgotten, is so powerful. I remember, I myself can reproduce instances many years ago when a poor woman used to bring me money in Boston. I should place her name on the memorial tablet in our yeshiva. And she used to count, used to charge $100 for my plaque. And she used to count the money in her hand were trembling. And one quarter and another quarter and a third quarter and a fourth quarter. And I used to ask her, tell me, my dear lady, how much savings do you have? What's my last savings? It's not the time of the depression. So why do you give the money to the yeshiva? You can't afford to do it. Rebbe, ich will am Zolman nicht vergessen, I want to be remembered. Once I'll die, I know my children will never remember me. They'll never come to shul to say, Yisker. Perhaps the yeshiva will remember once in a while. But it was an old woman. And this is not just the mentality of a primitive, unlettered
you literally do, but the very honest one, the sincere one, this is the mentality of Western man. When Johnson accepted the vice presidency offered by Kennedy, and it was a degrading acceptance, I would say a disgraceful acceptance, so one of the journalists asked him, why did you accept it? After as majority leader of the Senate, you have wielded so much power and influence, actually. The president was, you commanded the respect of the White House, and now as a vice president, you know what a vice president means in America. You'll just be an errand boy for the president. So he answered him, yes, yes. But history will give two more lines to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. History will devote few more words to the vice president than to the majority leader of the Senate. Power at present means nothing. I'll be remembered. That's what Johnson said. And Johnson is not a metaphysician, nor a philosopher, nor a man of exceptional spiritual perceptions. Even though he acted like a man, as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. But this is correct. And Yahadu's demands of man, anonymity. Let me give you an example. There are many boys who study Gemara here. But how many girls are here who study Gemara, I don't know. But boys quite anonymous. Tell me, you study Mishnah. Stam Mishnah. Stam Mishnah. Or you study Mishnah and there is a controversy between an individual and we call him the Tanekame. Who is the Tanekame? Who is it? So you ask me, who the Tanekame? Who answers me? You ask who the Tanekame is? This is the majority of Jewish scholars. What are their names? We don't know. Who is the Tanna Basra? You don't know. Tanna Rabbanon. Who are the Rabbanon? Who are they? Why was the Braise, who are our records, were so stingy? So tight-lipped in enumerating the names? It is not just a coincidence. It is not laziness or neglect on the part of our Chazal, it's a method, it's a policy. The greatest of all sacrifices a Jew brings when he's ready to sink into oblivion and remain in the shadows of anonymity. The orgiastic society, as well as the tyrannical, arrogant society, attempt to overcome human finiteness, the mimamakim awareness, by substituting public memory for metaphysical immortality. Yahadus did not accept it. On the contrary, it considered the quest for having one's name recorded in history as sheer vanity. The individual as such can never become a historical figure. Only the covenantal community is perpetuated by history, has claim an historical immortality. The service which the individual gives to the community is recorded, but his private life is never recorded. The very moment the service is completed, history is not concerned with him anymore. The ideal cathartic experience is that of anonymity. How many facts did the Torah record pertaining to the lives of the patriarchs or Moses? Only those periods were recorded which were directly intertwined with the service they rendered to the covenantal community. There is never a complete biography. Only fragments have been selected, namely those which tell us about the sacrificial surrender of the individual to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those who echo the great word Achineni, which rings through endless spaces, I am ready and willing to serve. Nothing else but the Hineni was recorded. It's very strange. We know much more about Aristotle and Socrates and Plato than we know about the Vilna Gaon. I mean biographical data. Very little. What do I know about my father? Very little. He never talked about himself. He never wrote an autobiography. He never reminisced. I just know some episodes. What do I know about the life of my grandfather, Avraham Chaim? Just single episode. They never confided their private affairs, their private experiences, their clandestine emotions to anyone. Whatever happened, happened between them and God. It has never been made public. It's an aspect of anonymity. God requires of man the highest of all sacrifices, anonymity, which is genuine humility. He hates glamour, fame, external glitter, and certainly vainglory. He loves the actor or the actress who appears on the stage for a short while, plays his or her part humbly and disappears immediately without receiving applause. Man stands in the limelight as long as he is the Messiah, the anointed who consecrated himself to the covenantal community. The very moment he finishes his job, the lights are dimmed, or rather extinguished, and he is out of sight. What does the Megillah tell us about Mordechai Yehudi and Esther Amalko? What did the Megillah tell us about Esther Amalko's life following the Haman episode? After all, she was a young girl when she was taken to the palace. She lived for many more years. I would like to know, did she remain the queen in Persia? Or Ahasuerus sent her back to Mordechai and invited Shargash and a goy to find another queen for him? It would be quite curious to know about it. The Megillah doesn't mention one word. And the story is finished. And she has removed herself from the stage. What do we know about Mordechai Yehudi? What we know? Nothing. We know the Yesa Poroshas Duas Mordechai, Ashagid Le'amalech, Harlem Ksuvim Al Sefer Divrei Ayomim, the Malchim Mordechai Uforos. Go ahead and find them and read the story. Yes. One episode, and a very short one, of their lives was recorded. The rest is anonymous. And if somebody would, and that's exactly what Micha said, Hageid lecho Adam Hateiv, Umad Hashem Derech Meimcho, Kimaseis Mishpot, Vehavas Chesed, Veatna Leches Simelekecho, It has been told thee, O man, what is God, what the Lord doth require of thee, all only to do justly and to walk humbly. I would say rather anonymously. Who is thy God? Anyway, we must underline the word humbly. And this is our answer to Menachem Minamater.